I am very pleased to welcome back to ARSC and the podium Carrie Janelle, who, as you know, won an ARSC award last year and has come back today to talk about Terry Gibbs. And he's a nice presentation. We're rushing him a little, which I very much regret, but things have just gone over a bit and the AV people have to move on. But I want to welcome Carrie now without much else. I'm going to see.
Well, first of all, I can't stand here in the company of everybody who has come before me without acknowledging what a wonderful series of presentations we have had, and I'm just honored to be among all of you who have made presentations. So can we give everybody another hand now? Great. And one more thing that has to be acknowledged. We were acknowledging Bob Hope on the first day. There are many famous artists in the recorded history in the 20th century who were born in 1903. I do want to acknowledge three of them, Bix Beiderbecke, Joe Venuti, and Bing Crosby, who we have to mention. Now, since we are pressed for time, thank goodness I got Terry Gibbs doing most of the talking because he talks fast, right? In fact, there was a story about Shorty Rogers, who talked very slowly when Shorty would call his wife with something that he needed to tell her. He'd write it down, give it to Terry, and Terry would get it done in about a minute. So that's how that would work. I met Terry Gibbs in 1999. I was asked to do a radio documentary for Jazz Profiles on National Public Radio on Terry. And I met him, and we put together the show, and after I interviewed him several times, I realized there's just too much good material just to be fit into a one-hour radio program. And so after discussing it with him, we decided to do a book together. And the way Terry presents himself, there is no way that a book about him can be written about him. It has to be written by him in his words. I found in interviewing him that he possessed all 10 attributes that I need for an ideal interview. And very quickly, those are: he was important, he was around other important people, he was there when important events were happening, he understood what was going on, he understood and had a clear head, not clouded by drugs or alcohol or anything else, he remembered things accurately, and believe me, I tried to corroborate just about everything that he told me, and he remembered things accurately. He survived, as so many people in the bebop world did not. He was able to communicate these memories, and he was able to communicate them in an interesting way. 100% was Terry Gibbs. Steve Rowland said that the best interviews result when the interviewer doesn't say much. So when I present some of this interview with Terry, you won't hear my voice very much. I gave him a list of 5 or 6 names. That's it. No questions. And he just responded, as you will see. So let's begin with the first introduction of Terry, and also forgive the rudimentary condition of the tape. Terry had hip replacement surgery a few weeks ago, did not want to do the interview until he had recovered sufficiently, and so I did the interview a week ago today, so 1 week ago. So just need some hard edits, that's about it. But let's go. Is the power on?
Yeah, turn the power on. 2003, Sherman Oaks.
Hello, Philadelphia. God, Philadelphia was one of my greatest towns to play in. I think I played, back in the 50s, every little toilet, which were called the clubs those days, and it was probably the most fun I ever had in my life playing all the clubs. It was great. I may look strange sitting like I am right now. It looks like I'm passing out, which I'm not. I just actually been out of the hospital about a week and a half or so after having a hip replacement operation, and I will not go through my corny hip jokes about being hip and hip on one side, because I've been hit with those all over the place. But I'll just talk a little about some of the records that Carrie Janelle is playing, and Carrie's standing right in back of the camera with his hands up in the air doing this, say something. I'm not sure what he's doing. Anyhow, I shouldn't be doing this because I'm liable to have another operation. What's the first record I'm going to... I'm going to talk a little about my actually... my performance on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour. Now, this December, the 25th or 23rd, will be 67 years that I have actually been traveling on the road, including Philadelphia. And this was a performance that somebody... I actually was conducting a television show in New York City, a telethon. And you always look forward when you're conducting a telethon to having guest conductors come in, especially those days, because it wasn't like the Jerry Lewis telethon where you rehearsed for 20 hours before the show. They threw music at you and you played it. So when somebody came in with their own musical director, you welcomed it. And this gentleman came in, and his name was Lloyd somebody. I forget his last name. And I mentioned that Lloyd, there was a Lloyd who played piano for me on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour when I was 12 years old, and he said, that was him. I said, it's amazing, because I won that amateur hour. And he said, what year? I said, 1936. I said, under the name Julius Kabenko, not Terry Gibbs. He said, I'll bring you a present tomorrow. And I forgot about it, went back to my conducting all the other acts. And the next day he came in with a... he made a little record for me from a transcription that he took off the Major Bowes Amateur Hour in 1936. Me playing Chardas by Monty, which we'll probably hear right now or will be played in a few seconds. And I actually think that legitimately I played my instrument better than I do now. Because playing classical music, you have to practice all the time. You have to practice no matter what, even playing with jazz. But jazz, you're instant composing. You don't know where your brain and your hands are going to. But in classical, you have a piece to play. So the first piece will be played. I think this will be called Chardas by Monty.
And can you talk a little bit about the Bowes show and how that worked?
Oh, well, the Major Bowes show was an amateur hour that people, you'd play on the air, and then people would call in votes. Now, I don't want to say the show was rigged, but it was rigged in a certain way, because after I played, before I played, actually, they told me that I was going to win. Because I had to leave after they put me on first on the show so I can catch a train to go to Pittsburgh to open up a theater the next day. So I knew that I was going to win. And also, they had two different things. They had me, first they said, about 2 days before the show, can you play something shorter, less time than Chardas by Monty? And my teacher mentioned The Flight of Bumblebee. So I went home and memorized it overnight and came back the next day to play it. And they said, listen, we changed our mind. We like to have a longer piece. We're going to put you on first so it'll be a little more impact, you know. So it was like a throwaway memorizing. No, I don't even remember memorizing. It just came natural to me. And I played Chardas by Monty on the show. And I won. Who knows how many votes I got. I know that the producer said I won, and that's all that counted.
Now, we're going to play your little conversation with Major Bowes, too.
Oh, are they? It's sickening. First of all, I can't act. I can't do lines. Even today, I can't do lines that don't come out of my mouth. In fact, my latest album, I sing Sunny Side of the Street because it's a tribute to Lionel Hampton. And that was hard for me. I performed in New York about 2 months ago, and I had to have the lyric in front of me because I don't say those words. I have never heard the word come out of my mouth. I'm a rover crossed over. I haven't got the slightest idea what it means. That's not how I talk. So I can't act. So anyhow, when these lines were given to me on Major Bowes, they were so corny, and they made me sound so cocky. And even though I was a child prodigy, and I knew that I could play, and I knew when I was good, and I knew when I was bad, I didn't like those lines because they made me look like a wise guy. And that's not my style.
So on with the show. Here is Major Bowes and his original Amateur Hour. Major?
Thank you, Ralph. And good evening, friends. As spinning goes our weekly Wheel of Fortune for the 145th time. Around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows. First, Julius Gubenko, xylophonist from Brooklyn, and he plays Chardas. How old are you, Julius?
12, Major. My ambition is to get an interview from
no,
you.
No, no, dear little boy. Just back a few inches, because it's now. Now, how old are you?
12.
That's good.
My ambition is to get an interview from you for our school newspaper. I thought if I can get to play on your program, maybe you'd let me interview you afterwards.
I see. Well, that's not unreasonable.
You don't have to answer any questions you don't want to.
Don't be afraid. I'll give full particulars. Where'd your talent lie, interviewing or xylophoning?
Pretty good at both. All my friends and all my teachers are listening in. I gave them the telephone number, Murray Hill 9933. I expect to get a lot of votes.
All right, Julius, you're a go-getter. Let's have Monty's Chardas on you.
Terry was diagnosed with St. Vitus's dance when he was young. He was always a very hyperkinetic person, and you can hear some of that in some of his playing. A lot of the details of his life, it's very complicated and extensive biography. You'll find some of that on page 2, so without delay, we're just going to go into the next number. I did want to mention, though, one of his early performances on record was for Savoy in 1947 with Alan Eager, one of the up-and-coming bebop tenor saxophonists who just passed away recently at the age of 76. We were going to play that record. I don't think we'll have time. If we do at the end, then maybe we can play it while everybody's packing up or something. So let's go on to the next one, the next part. It should all be uninterrupted now, just the video, Terry, interspersed with what you see on your program. And we're going to talk about Buddy Rich now, who he was in for a little while.
My experience with Buddy Rich's were up and down. It was, for a better use of words, I hate to even use love and hate. It was sort of a love and hate relationship. We loved each other, but we were separated 400 times in fighting. I used to box, and Buddy thought he was a boxer, so. And he never would pick on me. Buddy Rich was really nice to me, but he'd pick on the other guys in the band, and I'd always defend them. And every time I would, he said, it's none of your business. And the none of your business became an argument, and then almost a fist fight. Now, on this thing, you're going to watch a thing called John Had the Number. It's a thing I wrote that Johnny Mandel, the great songwriter, arranger, arranged for this little group. And on your, while you're watching it, you'll see Johnny playing the bass trumpet and Buddy's brother, Mickey Rich, playing tenor saxophone. Now, a wild thing about before we did this thing, how you do Now, you do a movie short those days, anyhow. Today, they may record live, because they may have the equipment. Those days, you had to go into a studio and record the song before they showed, before what you're watching. And what they did is, after we recorded, they gave me a record to take home and try to memorize my solo. Those days, I hadn't had the slightest idea what I played at all. I haven't memorized my solo. I tried to play different every time, so it was impossible. But luckily, because I played a percussive instrument moving, and being a percussion player, I memorized the articulation, where I hit the notes. Now, and then when they shot this thing, it looked like I did it right. If they were actually to record what I played, I think maybe three notes out of the whole solo may have been right. The timing was great, but I didn't care about the notes, because I didn't remember what I played anyhow. So they just gave me the thing, and I moved along according to what I was hitting. But who knows what I was hitting? In fact, I think that record today would be a big hit record for Ornette Coleman. So who knows what I did? I have not the slightest idea. But another thing that happened on that record day that was kind of, on that thing that was kind of funny. And this may be the only time that Buddy Rich could have been right about something. We recorded not so quiet, please. And once again, we had a lip sync or a vibe sync, whatever you want, drum sync, your solo. Now, when it came to Buddy's solo, he refused to drum sync his solo. And so they said, we don't have equipment to bring ahead to record you. No way, this is a movie studio. So every time they would shoot him do it, every time, and I can't bend over because of my hip, but every time you hear a cymbal, he would hit the bass drum. And every time you heard the bass drum, he hit the cymbal. Everything was completely out of sync with what you were watching. We were there 4 hours and made 4,000 takes of Buddy trying to play. And finally, they brought in equipment. And so when you listen, if you have a chance to listen to the whole thing, when the band is playing, he is lip syncing. He's whatever he's doing. And it's one sound. But when he plays his drum solo, it's a completely different sound because they had to bring in equipment, and it's much more echoey and wide open because it wasn't a studio recording. But that may be the only time Buddy could have been right about something, because how he plays, it would be impossible for him to drum sync his solo. I mean, he's all over the drums. Who knows what he did? And Buddy also, even though we all have our own tricks and he had his own gimmicks, they would not be in the same place all the time when he played them. But that's about maybe the only time that I know that Buddy Rich could have been right about something. I was on Woody Herman's band. We recorded a song called Lemon Drop that became a big hit. And it became a big hit for me because I had this low voice, one of those dumb voices like Popeye. I can't even do it anymore. I'm out of shape. We recorded that and it became a hit. Now, I have an autobiography that came out April 1st, which Carrie Janelle helped me write. And my favorite chapter is the Woody Herman chapter because of all the famous musicians and all the things that went on. It was one of the, probably at that time, it was the greatest band in the world. And if you listen to those records today, it still could be one of the greatest bands of all time. And I'll just tell you a story, short story about Lollipop. After Lemon Drop came out, I wrote a sequel. Shorty Rogers and I used to write a lot of songs together. And how we used to write sometimes is, I would write the majority of the song, and maybe Shorty would write the release, but then he'd write the arrangement. And the arrangement was just as important as the song. So we'd both get credit for the song. Now, when we rehearsed the song, we were not performers. We did not perform. We were just young kids. Woody, of course, was a performer. So when we had rehearsed, they had microphones in front of us. And we held on to the mics for dear life. We didn't know what to do with our hands. And then when they shot this thing after rehearsal, once again, it's lip-syncing. And they gave us no microphones. Now, I don't remember what you're watching, but I do remember that Shorty and I, first we did one take before this, and like idiots, we were doing choreography. We didn't know what to do. Now, it's good to do choreography if there's some lyrics. But what do you do choreography to? You're like a complete fool. So somebody told us, forget about the choreography. And I remember we kept our hands straight down because we didn't know what to do, and we sang what we just watched or are watching right now. Now, the Woody Herman Band, you have to, I hate to say you have to buy the book, but if you really want to read some stories about people that nobody knows. Now, the only people alive from this band right now is Don Lamont, who unfortunately is on his way out too. I think he had a brain tumor. And Chubby Jackson, who's fighting cancer and dialysis, and he's not in good shape. So anyhow, these stories in my book are stories that are between the person, if I'm talking about Stan Getz, only Stan Getz and I would know that story. Or Serge Chaloff and I would know this story. Or Woody and I would know this story. So if you want to read something completely different than you know about these people, it's another side of Stan Getz and Serge Chaloff and Woody Herman and Shorty Rogers and Levy, all the people that were on the band. The book is called, I'm plugging my book and I should, Good Vibes. It's on Scarecrow Press, Good Vibes for Life and Jazz. Now, the Woody Herman Band for me was probably one of the biggest thrills of my life, because when I got called to join the band, just thinking about who was in the band, Stan Getz, Zoot Sims, Al Cohen, Shorty Rogers, and then later on Red Rodney, and Bill Harris, and God, it was like an all-star band. Everybody in that, Ralph Burns, everybody that was in that band later on either became a famous jazz artist or wound up writing for the movie pictures. So it was an honor to play with the band. And there are lots of stories I can tell.
Tell one Serge Chaloff story.
Well, let me give you one of my famous Serge Chaloff stories, which are on a bunch of books besides mine. Serge was probably the greatest liar in the world. Serge also, unfortunately those days, was hooked on dope, as most of the guys in the band were, unfortunately, except for myself and a few other guys. And Serge, when we would check in a hotel, if he checked in on the fourth floor, you checked in on the first floor. If he was on the 11th floor, you'd gamble and check on the third floor because he'd always fall asleep and burn a hole in his mattress and the whole hotel can go up. But he'd always get caught by the manager burning a hole in his mattress. And Serge was one of the greatest liars, I said, and he would have an argument with the manager. The manager would say, "You, Mr. Chaloff, you burnt a hole in that mattress, it's going to cost you $20, whatever it was." And Serge would say, "How dare you, sir? I'm the winner of the Downbeat Metronome Bowl. How dare you?" And he, "How dare you, sir?" until for a half hour until the manager would wind up apologizing to him. Now, I was a clothes freak, and I used to carry two bags full of clothes, which I never wore, except when the band boy would bring it up to my room, and I would try it on and wear it in the room. That's the only time I wore it. And I went to, you can buy a suit those days for $12 or $15, but I went to Woody's Tailor and bought five suits for $100 each. I saved my money, and I would wear it in the room. Anyhow, the whole band got on an air pistol kick. we bought air pistols, and at night we'd be shooting out the windows. We would be shooting for our trees, probably killed 700 cows on the way back from one job to another. But Serge was slept all the time on the bus because he was out. But when he got to the room and checked in, one day he put a telephone book against the door and shot at the telephone book and tried to hit it. And out of 24 shots, one went into the book and 23 went into the door. So the next day when we were checking out of the hotel, I'm walking by his room and he sees me, he says, Terry, wait a second. How dare you, sir? And the manager accused him of making a hole in the door. How dare you, sir? I'm the winner of the Dalby Pole and the Metronome Pole. How dare you accuse me of making a hole in that door? How dare? And the manager said, listen, it's going to cost you $24 for that door, or I'm calling the police. How dare you, sir? It did no good. He says, I'm calling the police. So he says, wait a minute. If I'm paying for that door, I want that door. And he looked at me and said, Terry, come here. So he waited. I came in. The manager went downstairs and got a screwdriver, whatever, and unhinged the door. And Serge and I walked out of the hotel with my two suitcases and a door, with 23 holes in the door. My good friend Serge Chalov.
Woody Herman expanded the same idea by presenting two of his musicians featuring a bop vocal in unison. This is a typical fast-moving melody of that era, composed and sung by Shorty Rogers and Terry Gibbs. Lollipop, from the Herman's Herd film in 1950. Serge Chalov.
As you can see, I'm holding a picture of the Benny Goodman Quintet. I think it's a quintet on this, from a show we did called the Star Time, Star Time show in, I think it was about 1951. And Benny Goodman was probably the biggest thrill of my life working with, because as a kid going to the Paramount Theater in New York City, I probably was the first one in line to get to see Benny Goodman. And never in my born day did I ever think that I ever worked for him. Now, seeing him in person and hearing him play and not even knowing him at all and looking at that person, you visualize whatever the you think that he is. You know, it's, you don't know, all you know, you're hearing a giant clarinet player playing. But then when I got to work with him and got to know him a little bit, that person that I was visualizing became another person. That person was like a genius to me. This other person off stage was a complete idiot. He was very foggy. The reason I say that, I say this all with respect once again, because that was he was like a god to me, just my own Benny Goodman. But I mean, he was as foggy as you can get. He could memorize The Flight of the Bumblebee overnight, Clarence Allen King overnight. He could memorize anything. The only thing he couldn't memorize or remember was your name. He called everybody in the world Pops. Women, children, dogs, fire hydrants. Everybody was Pops. By the way, all these stories, once again, I'm going back to my book, they're all in the book. And once again, you should get it because there's 4 million Benny Goodman stories. Benny was out there. He was really that foggy. Couldn't remember your name at all. I'll never get, remember one time we were rehearsing in his house in Connecticut. And his wife Gladys came in, and she was very nice. And she said,
really,
Benny,
Alice,
should I bring the musician some Cokes? And he looked at her, he says, not now, Pops. Couldn't remember his wife's name. I don't want to get into what happened in their sex life or anything, but I always thought, what would happen when they were alone together, making love? I love you, Benny. Oh, great, Pops. I don't know what would happen, but it had to be out there, because every story that I always told about Benny made him, you can't help tell these stories, and it's not only just me, it's everybody that ever worked with Benny Goodman. I spent a week on a cruise with Mel Powell, the piano player that worked with me for a long time, and he had the greatest stories. Now, before I worked for Benny Goodman, I used to hear these stories, and they sounded so far-fetched that it may have started out with one guy talking about a red shirt, and after it came around 20 other people, somebody was talking about a pair of black shoes. It sounded that far-fetched. But after I worked for him for on and off about 2.5 years, I realized that every story I ever heard about him was true. The man was out in left field. I'll give you one more story about Benny Goodman. We were doing the Ken Murray show, and it was a show that Teddy Wilson could not be there. He had other commitments. So they hired a piano player, his office, not Benny, off a piano player called Bernie Layton. Now the whole world knows, sorry, I'm trying to get my energy up. The whole world knows that that Teddy Wilson was black, a very famous black piano player. And I say the word black because it has something to do with the story. Black piano player. And Bernie Layton was as white as you can get, even his hair was, compared to Teddy, he looked like an albino. His hair was light. And we rehearsed whatever we played on the show. All week, we rehearsed about 8 times a day because the cameraman has to get his shots and all these things. And the director has to pick them out. We played this one song and went off to the right. No dialogue between Ken Murray and Benny Goodman. Song off to the right. And now the whole week there, Benny hasn't said hello or goodbye or how you feel anything to Bernie Layton. Never even recognized him as being in the band. Now we do the show and we play our song, and Ken Murray got that sign, which means stretch, we need a little more time. So Ken Murray, after we finished playing a song, he said, hey, Benny. Now, Benny never heard that during rehearsal. Hearing that through Benny occurred, what do you want? Martell, what do you want? He said, come over here a second. So now Benny had to walk to the left, which was another curve, because that was something he didn't rehearse at all. He walked over to him and he says, who's in the band? He tried to back him, and Benny looked at me, and Benny left, by the way, as I said earlier, my legal name was Gubenko, and he loved that name. When he called everybody Pops, he called me Gubenko. And he looked at me and he tried to say Terry Gibbs. He said, and vibes, Gubenko. Wonderful. All my old Jewish relatives in Brooklyn loved it. My mother loved it. I was Gubenko again. Now, he did get, I think it was Don Lamont Terry Snyder, rather, and he got the other guys straight. He got their names, and then looked at a piano player. Bob Carter was on bass, and Terry Snyder on drums. He looked at a piano player that he never saw before and looked at him and he said, on piano, Teddy Wilson. Now, the whole band, we all were still there. We didn't know what to do. We looked to see who played piano. We didn't believe that anybody, make up a name, Sam Schwartz, Irving Tannenbaum, whatever. But Teddy Wilson, because I said, that's why I mentioned, the whole world knows that Teddy's black and he's an albino sitting there. And that's where Benny was. Benny was out in left field.
Now watch this clip carefully. You'll watch, he'll get all the guys' names right, but he does a double take when he sees Teddy Wilson, just to make sure.
Now I'd like to introduce the members of the group. First, Terry Gibbs at the vibraphone, Terry Snyder at the drums, Bob Carter at the bass fiddle, and one of the stellar lights in the jazz world, Teddy Wilson at the piano. And now we're going to play Temptation Rag. Take it, Theodore.
Young lady called Terry Pollard, who worked for me for 4 years. She was that good that when she first joined my band in New York, the first day she was there, Charlie Parker offered her a job. And we were at the club for a whole week at the Birdland, and every day for a whole week he offered a job. So you know how good she was. Anyhow, she recorded a whole bunch of albums with me. There were no CDs those days. And she did a Steve Allen show with me. In 1956, we appeared on the Steve Allen show. And she played piano on the first song, and which you'll see here after a while or before this. And you hear how great she played, and she was one of a kind. And then we did a vibe duet. Now, there's some good young vibe players today, but I don't know anybody today that plays as good as Terry Pollard played in 1956. She was that good a vibe player that that now this is being shown after, right, Carrie? After.
We'll do it before.
Okay, before.
No, well, we're gonna do you first and then show it.
Okay, as you see the video, you'll see that no matter how good I may be playing, she keeps up with me, and
you know, not only that, she's beating rhythm with her sticks when you're playing.
Well, she was that good. First of all, she couldn't read one note of music. Everything she played was by ear. Now that song we're playing now at the time is in the key of F, which is easy for anybody. But if I said let's play it in F sharp, she as good as she played there in F, she wouldn't have played in F as good in F sharp. Only I wouldn't have played it as good. I wouldn't know what I'm playing at all. She was that good. you'll see that while we're playing the vibe duet, she pushes me. We have this sort of routine, but she pushes me off the stage. Now, when Terry would be going with some guy or something while she was on my band, and if it wasn't a good day for her, if they have kind of scene, now you'll see how she throws me off the stage. She would take it out on me. Not only would she play that good, the routine would be out. All of a sudden, she's now playing some jazz on her own, and I'd have to keep up with her. But when she pushed me off the stage, I would wind up in Pittsburgh. I'm talking about being pushed off, boom. But she was my band for 4 years, and it was an honor for me to have her in the band. She was that good. I think she was probably the first of that cliche of girl musicians where they said play good for a girl. She didn't play good for a girl. She played good for a jazz player.
I forgot to mention Herman Wright is playing the bass, but Herman made that fact very well known. You're now over at Birdland, are you?
That's right.
Jerry Southern?
Jerry Southern, Tony List, and Selton Powell.
Tony over there, sir? Sounds like a great combination.
We're going from here to Norfolk, Virginia.
Sure.
The Continental.
How long will you be there?
We'll be here for a week, and then we go to Red Hill Inn in Camden, New Jersey.
I envy you people who are on the road. So I guess it has its problems, like what do you do with your laundry, but you get to see a lot of the country.
It's fun.
What do you do with your laundry now that I bring it up? Like if you're in a town for 3 days.
I send it to my mother.
Send it to your mother? Really?
No. We get it done. Once in a while, you don't get a place where you can get it done in one day. Uh-huh. Most of the time, you can. Lucky.
The fellas told me I could help you out on this next tune.
Oh, you
by
sure
doing
can.
By leaving, or...
you can play some changes for us. Terry and I are going to do a duet. Yes, sure.
Oh, all right. What tune?
Blue. Now is the time to feel F.
F?
Or to do it easy.
All right.
By the way, he taught that routine to Steve Allen, also to Alice Coltrane, Pat Moran, and Don Elliott.
I had a band called the Dream Band. It was called Terry Gibbs Dream Band. It was actually named by Ralph Kaffel, the president of Fantasy. Indirectly, it was named the Dream Band because the first album we put out, the title of the album was called the Dream Band. And it made so much noise, the band hit so big that there are six volumes now of the Dream Band, and everyone was titled the Dream Band. Well, before this thing you're going to watch is of one of the Dream Bands, most of the musicians from the original band. But before we did this, we did a three-hour television show, a PBS show with Steve Allen, with the same band. And these guys had to play for 3 hours and rehearse 3 hours. After we did 6 hours of this, we went into a studio and did what you're going to hear now. And you would never know that they played for 6 hours in a row because they were so proud of the band. I think John Ordino and Pete Condoli played lead trumpet. Connie Condoli was one of the jazz soloists. I remember Paul Smith, who was played piano on it. And Frank Capp played drums. I met Florey, who was there. And I think Bob Cooper, I'm not sure some of the musicians, because I'm not watching the video. But anyhow, I remember going into the studio and we had to do one take on practically every song. Actually, we did two takes. The director got a chance to listen to the song the first time, and then we did a take. And so we did two takes on every tune, and it was great. I think his name was Bill Hoban. He was a great director. I think he used to direct the Red Skelton shows. But it was all done, the whole thing was done in how long the video is. I think there are 10 songs or 12 songs, and there were probably 3-4 songs. So we spent about an hour, a little over an hour, recording this whole thing, and it showed off the band, and we played Opus Number 1, which now I always use as an opener, because unlike what you're watching there, what you'll be watching, on the last chorus, on the last shout chorus, the saxophones stand up, and then the trombones stand up, and the trumpets stand up. It's like old-time big band style. And it's like, I believe in opening up by knocking people out if possible. So all you people in the back, you better wake up. Wake up. Don't fall asleep to my music.
That was Terry Gibbs.
Buddy and I recorded for Fantasy, and then we did a PBS show while we were in San Diego. It was called Club Date. It was a series of shows that PBS station was doing. I think they recorded Bud Shank and a whole bunch of people that played at the club that we played at. And we played the karaoke, and a strange thing about this thing is, on the karaoke, because I didn't know the song that well when I wrote the arrangement, I think I made it a 24-bar song instead of a 32-bar song. I always, when we played jazz choruses, we always left out the last 8 bars of the solo. And I don't know why, but it still sounds good. And Buddy and I, we have a magic when we play together. It's great. We use 2 local musicians from San Diego, which I don't remember the name, and my son Jerry. Jerry did playing drums on it, and he played a lot on record dates with Buddy and I, and live performances. But this was a fun thing, because Buddy and I have fun playing every time we play together. It's just, there's a magic with Buddy and I. We get together, I may not see Buddy for 6 months, because we both have our own things we do, and then we have to meet in I'll never forget, in Berlin, at the Berlin Jazz Festival, and I'll meet him on stage. We say hello, and they say, Buddy DeFranco, Terry Gibbs, boom, on stage, and we'll already start playing. No rehearsal or anything, we just start playing. Well, the musicians that play for us, we gave them lychees, the songs that we play, and we send them along before we play there, and we just start playing, and you could have sworn that Buddy and I just played last night and the night before that. So we have a magic when we play. I love him, he's like my brother. Philadelphia, I think that's the end of my show. It's been fun sitting here. I wish you could get a whole full picture of what I'm sitting at. I'm stretched out with my leg, has to be raised a little higher. And within 4 weeks from now, I will be straight. I hope I'll have all the energy to get back to playing again. But it's been fun doing this thing and reminiscing, sort of. I'm sitting here with Carrie reminiscing about what you'll be watching. And I hope you enjoy all this, because it's really history, things you're watching in history, because some of these things will never be out on any kind of any videos for you to buy. I hope you enjoyed it. And now I said hello, Philadelphia, and now goodbye, Philadelphia. See y'all later.
You can...
Thank you.
You can see how working with Terry Gibbs is pretty easy, pretty easy work. I just want to read one closing thing from the book in Terry's words, since he's not here to do it for you. In 2000, the Percussive Arts Society inducted me into their Hall of Fame. The PAS, as it is known, has thousands of members all over the world, and that award meant more to me than any other because it came from my peers. I think that I was the 77th musician inducted into the Hall of Fame in all the years they've been in existence. 3/4 of the musicians in the Hall of Fame are symphony players, and most of the jazz musicians are drummers. Besides me, Lionel Hampton, Red Norvo, Milt Jackson, and Gary Burton are the only vibes players in the PAS Hall of Fame. When I was presented with my plaque at the banquet, I had to make a speech, and I was a little nervous and didn't know how to get into it. The other inductees had their speeches already written, and I couldn't do that, so I just ad-libbed mine. 3 years before I was honored, I was asked to play as a guest with the Navy Band at the Percussive Arts Society convention at the Disneyland Hotel in Los Angeles. I must be honest, I had never heard of the PAS before, and I never knew anything about the organization. I rehearsed with the Navy Band for a program in which they would open the show and play for the first 20 minutes. Then I would close the show by playing the next 40 minutes. The Navy Band was great, and at the rehearsal, they played the heck out of my music. One of the reasons was that every one of them was a big fan of the Dream Band, and they were knocked out just getting a chance to play some of those arrangements. When it came showtime, the Navy Band got carried away and played about 45 minutes of high-powered music, and I had to follow them playing more high-powered music. Well, I learned something from Steve Allen. He once told me that the best way to follow music with music was when you're first introduced, talk to the audience, and let them rest their ears for about 3 to 5 minutes. I usually do that when I'm first introduced anyhow. When I follow another act, instead of going right into the music, I always use one of Steve's lines. Are you enjoying the show? Everybody usually applauds, and then I say, well, I'll put a stop to that. I intended to do this, but I thought I would thank the Percussive Arts Society, or PAS as it was called, for inviting me to appear at their convention. Being unfamiliar with the organization, I started out and said, I'd like to thank the PSA for inviting me to their convention. And before I had a chance to say the line that I stole from Steve Allen, everybody started to laugh. I didn't know why, so I said, what's so funny? Somebody in the audience yelled out, PSA is a prostate test. Well, thank God for my fast brain. I said, I'm sorry, I'm at the wrong convention, and walked off the stage. As I look back at my life, I've been very lucky and had a great time. I'm not through living yet. In fact, my next autobiography will start when I'm 80 years old, and I intend to have as much fun as I had the first 80 years. I'll say goodbye now by quoting 2 clichés. One is familiar, and the second I'll improvise on a little. I'm allowed to because I'm a jazz musician. Even though we know that into each life a little rain must fall, all in all, I've been very fortunate, for I've been able to laugh all the way to the bandstand. And just as a footnote, I talked to Terry last night, and he is already off of his walker and playing the vibes again.
Thank you.
Thanks to Carrie and everyone else. Carrie had to operate under a little pressure there. Our staff here agreed to stay late, for which I'm grateful to them for that and for everything else.